Okay, well, in the last installment of this series, we saw the Israelites basically at the doorstep of the Promised Land, where they actually went ahead and blew it. They sent one leader out from each one of the tribes to go scope it out, and the report they brought back was positive and negative. I mean, it was positive in the fact that it was everything that Jehovah said it would be, but then negative in that 10 out of the 12 were all scared and reported that they were just unconquerable over there. But the people, rather than listening to the two that had faith and trust in Jehovah and his ability to be able to, carry through with his promise, they listened to the 10, and that didn't go too well for them. God was definitely not pleased with that. So we closed out that chapter with Jehovah's decision based on Moshe's prompting not to just wipe them out right there where they stood, but rather to make them, of course, wander in the wilderness and wait for all those adults to die out, and then maybe the next generation would enter. So as we get into the next chapter here, chapter 14, we get confirmation of that actually in these first couple of verses. It says that the Lord spoke to Moshe saying, "When you speak to the children of Israel and say to them, 'When you've come into the land that you're about to inherit, which I am giving to you,'" well, you notice that I highlighted when. That must have given them some peace, I think, because it's not if. It's when they come into the land. So this does confirm that even though Jehovah was certainly not very pleased with them, especially with that generation, it doesn't mean that he's not going to continue to honor his covenant. And from this is actually leading into him giving instructions on some things, some additional instructions on what to do once they get there. He says, when you come into the land, he says, start to, you need to do these things. And he starts with offerings. We're going to read verse 3 here, and 3 to 5. It says, "When you come in and you make an offering by fire to the Lord, a burnt offering or sacrifice to fulfill a vow, or as a freewill offering, or in your appointed feasts, to make a sweet aroma to the Lord from the herd or the flock. Then he who presents his offering to the Lord shall bring a grain offering of 1/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with 1/4 of a hin of oil, and 1/4 of a hin of wine as a drink offering you shall prepare with the burnt offering or the sacrifice for each lamb." So I got to this chapter, and I've started my study here to prepare for this week, and I debated with myself how to address this, because in this series, when we were back in Leviticus, we spent a lot of time on these sacrifices. We spent a lot of time looking at the impact of them, the symbology of them, and how every one of them really pointed us back to Yeshua, or forward to Yeshua. We covered the Olah and the Minka sacrifice and the Atah sacrifice. We covered all of these, and all three of those are alluded to in this chapter. So I made the decision not to delve into them again. So this whole section here, from here down to through verse 14, dealing with these sacrifices, I'm going to skip over. Okay, that's all right. I want to skip down to verse 15. Reading 14 first, it says, "If a stranger dwells with you, or whoever is among you throughout your generations, and would present an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord, just as you do, so shall he do. One ordinance shall be for you for the assembly," that's the whole of the tribes, "and for the stranger who dwells with you, an ordinance forever throughout your generations. As you are, so shall the stranger be before the Lord. One law and one custom shall be for you and for the stranger who dwells with you. A couple of things I want to talk about here. And it does directly relate to us today with respect to our relationship with God through Yeshua. Verse 16 says, I think, pretty plainly, right? There's to be one law for you and one for the stranger who dwells within you. One law for both, right? Pretty clear, I thought. But in my studies this week on this chapter, I came across a teaching and a belief by the ancient rabbis, clear back, that this only applies in the places and applicable to the law and the thing that is being spoken about at that time in that context. Okay? That then this would mean that he's referring to this law about presenting an offering made by fire, but it would not apply to other things. Because we do see that a lot, because he does say this in many places. Let me show you another one here. Leviticus 17. Every person who eats what died naturally or what was torn by beasts, whether he is a native of your own country or a stranger, he shall both wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. He shall be clean. So again, he puts that in this context for this particular thing. And so the question is, why state this if the previous statements that there should be just one law, if that doesn't apply to everything? That's what the rabbis questioned. In other words, it's not all the laws that apply to the strangers among you, just the ones where it's specifically stated. Otherwise, it might just say, like it does many times, speak to the children of Israel, and not give this command stating that it's for the ger, the stranger, as well. Now, when I read this, it made me bristle up a bit, because I never looked at it this way. And I've always seen these as blanket statements, which to me would correspond with other statements like, God is no respecter of persons, right? That once a person would accept Yehovah as God, then they would become like a natural born Israelite, right? Now, where do we get that? We get that perspective from Paul. We have this teaching of him of the olive tree and its branches. In writing about ancient Israel and then us as former strangers, Paul said this, Romans 11. For if the first fruit is holy, the lump is also holy. If the root is holy, so are the branches. And if some of the branches were broken off, and you, being a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them. You see where he's going, right? I mean, you've got the natural Israelite, and then you've got the Gentile. If you as a Gentile, a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them, and with them became a partaker of the root and fatness of the olive tree, but don't boast against the branches. But if you do boast, remember that you do not support the root, but the root supports you. That's Yeshua. You will say then, branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. Well said. Because of unbelief, they were broken off. And you stand by faith, but do not be haughty, but fear. You can kind of see, you know, why we get this impression then that, you know, all of the laws, you know, you got to remember. And this is what occurred to me. Paul was a very well-educated rabbi in Judaism. He was entrenched. He was a rabbi of rabbis, right? He had been taught all of these ancient, all these beliefs and perspectives of a rabbi. And when I thought about that and considered that maybe, just maybe, he too believed this statement in Numbers, that it did not apply to everything, all the law, only those things to which Yehovah specifically made this statement about. Because that's what the rabbis believed. And so that's what he was taught. And so what if that's what Paul still believed and was still part of his perspective when he wrote the things that he wrote under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit? Because that is different than what my perspective has been, meaning that this would apply to everything once they became part of Israel. It would apply to all the law, accepting Yehovah as the one true Elohim made them part of all that was going on, my view. But that's not what they had. Was Paul taught that there was one law for the stranger and the natural born only for those laws that God specifically said it? Was the stranger treated differently in some cases? Were they looked at as second class? And if so, how would that have affected his teachings to both the Jews and the Gentiles? So this difference in seeing that all the law applies to the strangers versus only some of it, and the fact that Paul may have agreed with and wrote with that in mind, is an interesting question. And so I kind of went off on this deal. It's one I decided to explore it. It took a lot of my study time. So allow me then to share a few conclusions around this. First off, the word here for stranger is what I pointed to earlier. It's ger. As a group, you would find the word gerim, G-E-R with an I-M at the end. And this protected stranger is what's known as kind of the best biblical definition. Our culture might say resident alien. Hebrew scholars say that we really don't have a good solid translation for the word that would encompass everything, because in their culture there was a whole lot of general understanding about what a ger was. So when you said ger, they had all this general understanding around it, but it's not really encompassed in our translations of it. And this word is used in a lot of different contexts. In their culture, a ger, which a stranger at this point, is deserving of hospitality. It could be a complete stranger that is traveling and comes across your home. You would not only welcome them in, giving them food and shelter, but also protection and sanctuary. And this protection was guaranteed by the very lives of the hosts. In other words, you come into my house, I'm going to defend my home, I'm going to defend you with it. Okay? Hence, we get this definition of protected stranger, because it hints a little bit toward the culture's idea of what a ger or gerim is. Now, and I got to give you this background. Should a stranger decide and is invited then to stay and contribute to the family or the tribe or whatever, they would have to pronounce loyalty to that tribe. In other words, they would defend them too. Okay? And so the care and the protection that would come from the tribe or the family, they would continue to be the beneficiary of that as long as they continued to be loyal to the tribe. Okay? So I'm speaking in general terms of the culture here, right? In one of the commentaries I read, there was they referenced an explanation of the word Ger by a guy named W.R. Smith, and it was kind of considered to be the most concise description, and here it is. The word Ger goes back to a nomadic life, and it denotes a man of another tribe or district who, coming to sojourn or travel to another place where he was not strengthened by the presence of his own kin, he would put himself under the protection of a clan or a powerful tribal chief. And that would be a Ger. So the Ger joins in and commits loyalty to the new tribe or leader, and in return can stay with them and be protected by their numbers, their power, okay? Now, a Ger can't own land. He's a stranger. He doesn't own land. And so generally they're laborers, or they've got some sort of skill or trade that they can participate and be, they can contribute to that society. However, they are under the authority of whatever tribe or clan they have attached themselves to. The protected stranger is to follow the clan or tribe or whatever's laws, and also they are not to offend that tribe or clan's god, okay? They're not slaves, they're not misfits, they're not a lower class of human, but they are second class in that sense, citizens with fewer privileges like owning land. And so that's really important for you to understand, because that's the culture. So that's how the rabbis then would see a Ger, okay? Now then, if a Ger stayed long enough, you know, over time, he would probably marry into that clan. Or if he was already married, maybe his children married into the clan. And eventually, you know, over a generation or so, would maybe lose that designation of a Ger. But that's not the point at the moment, because you have to understand the culture that they would have seen a Ger as not having all of the privileges of the tribe or family itself. And even all that doesn't fully encapsulate the broadness of this word. I mentioned that a Ger could not own land. Well, the Israelites saw, as a whole, saw themselves as Ger to Yehovah, right? Why? Because they were not allowed to own the land permanently. Look at this in Leviticus 25. Verse 23 says, "The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine." What's it say? "For you, Israel, are strangers," you're Ger, "and sojourners with me." So the strangers were Ger to the Israelites, and the Israelites were Ger to Yehovah. It's all gonna come around. Just hang with me. In addition, now think about this application. The Levites were separated from the rest of Israel. We've covered that many times. They came under, though, the protection of the tribes. The Levites were actually Ger to the Israelites. So the Israelites had Ger from outside. They had Ger from the the Levites, and they themselves were girded to Jehovah. Protected strangers. Let me go back here. We look at this definition. I would say that this gives then an interesting perspective to those that decided to go with Israel out of Egypt. Many of them had sojourned to Egypt to do business and found themselves in the thick of this, all of the plagues, and then decided to, as this says, to put themselves under the protection of a clan, the Israelites, or a powerful tribal chief. And what were they seeing? They were seeing this God. He's very powerful. Well, maybe let's put ourselves under him. And even some of the Egyptians themselves, some of their family members. I mean, at the end, the eldest was being killed, and so, well, okay, maybe I'm losing that clan. Maybe I should go with this one. So you can just kind of see how this kind of comes together, right? It really fits, doesn't it? It really makes sense why there's so many Gur or Gurim that left with the tribes of Israel. And we have to understand the way that then they would have seen them in their culture. And in their culture, they were hospitable. They came under their protection. But it did not mean that they were part of the tribe in the same way as the regular members, culture-wise. This is why Jehovah had to specifically state that there be one law for the stranger and the same law for the Israelites, because this was counterculture. It was counterculture to them. But again, now, is the statement blanket or just applicable to the things specifically where it's stated? That's the question. The rabbis believed it was just when stated. And what they did was they divided the law into kind of four overlapping parts: civil law and religious law. Within those, you had prohibited things that were prohibited from being done, like you can't murder, you can't steal. Those would go in this civil prohibitive category. Then you all, and this is what the rabbis did. Then you also had religious laws. Okay, some of those were prohibited as well, like unclean meats. Right? Okay. Some of them were things that were subscribed to do, things that they were to carry out and do, okay? So what the rabbis taught was that the Gur had to adhere to all the civil prohibited things. They even had to go with the things that were religious that were also prohibited. They were not allowed to offend their God, right? It goes with the culture. But they made the distinction and said the things that are religious that we get to do to serve our God, well, they don't get to do. Okay? So that part of the law is not required of a Gur. Oh boy. Well, you can see how pretty quickly, when this sort of thing reaches the ear of a mainstream Christian, what are they going to say? See? All those religious laws are not required because you're not a natural Israelite. And even your Jewish roots, the rabbis, they believed and taught the same thing. Well, I'd say just chill, because we need a little bit more understanding. One begins to see again, that the rabbis had this sort of tiered system of application. A ger was to comply with and not commit sin. They were not to do the things that were prohibited, either civil or religious, but being a ger, they were not regarded as equals in the sense of being able to participate in the religious things that the Israelites were commanded to do. And it's those things. Can you see now how they get lifted up in these kind of attitudes that we see in the, you know, at the time of Yeshua? That the Israelites, the things that they were able to do in their relationship with Yehovah, set them apart, class better than the ger, or these Gentiles. Okay, right? So now again, I'm not telling you this is right. I'm just telling you what they thought and what they taught as rabbis. Now, why does this help us, and why does it matter? Because, as I said at the beginning, Paul was a rabbi. Paul was a rabbi. And so, how did this influence him? I'm going to read you a section of Paul's writing in Ephesians chapter 2. And I want you to hear this and pretend that Paul shared in his original teaching and learning this tiered system of applying the law prior to his conversion. But then also see that it had influence when teaching about the revelation of the salvational work of Yeshua. Doing so, you might actually just get a little peek into the psyche of a guy that had a whole lot of ancient concepts floating around in his head and needing to reconcile those with expanded meaning. Here we go, Ephesians 2, starting verse 8. For by grace you've been saved through faith, that not of yourselves, it's the gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast. Stop there for a minute. Think about this. If the teaching that Paul got was like the other rabbis, and the law is divided up into the prohibitive civil things and the prescriptive religious things, what do you suppose his perspective of works is here that would elevate one to a higher class? Did the religious works that the Israelites got to do that the ger didn't, is that what elevates them? Is that what saved them? Did those works that they got to do that the ger didn't, did that save them? Let's continue. Keep going. Verse 10. For we are his workmanship, created in Messiah Yeshua for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Therefore, remember that you, once Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision, made in the flesh by hands, that at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenant of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. Just stop there again. I'm trying to get in his head. If he sees this tiered system as the rabbis saw it, then here Paul is using that perspective in making his point. He is speaking to Gentiles that were not even ger to the Israelites. They, you and me, we're not traveling with them. We haven't engaged in their clan, in their Judaism, to try to start walking some of that. We're not traveling with them. We're not living with them. We didn't even have the protection of Israel. We're completely outside the camp, outside any benefit at all of the covenant people. He is saying that you weren't even Ger. You were not tied to the covenant in any way. You were not there being loyal and at least obeying the prohibitive laws, let alone not being part of the covenant and therefore doing the works of the prescriptive religious laws. No, you were completely outcast. He says, no hope, zero, completely without any connection to God. You really see some sort of carryover here in Paul from this zealous rabbi that was taught these things, and it kind of comes through. It's his frame of reference, and so he's going to use those things to teach. You can see these three tiers, not just here, but other writings of his too, that there is one that is completely outside the camp, like other nations, Gentiles. Then there are those that are Ger, that are attached to Israel, loyal and protected strangers. And then there's Israel itself, the ones that are doing the real works, right, of the law. Continue on in verse 13. But now in Yeshua Messiah, you who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, who has made both one. Who's the both? The one that's outside of Israel completely, not even a Ger, and one that is brought near. You've broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is, the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create himself one new man from the two, thus making peace, and that he might reconcile them both to God in one body through the stake, thereby putting to death the enmity. And he came and preached peace to you who were afar off and those who were near. And through him we both have access by one Spirit to the Father. Again, both referring to those separated from Israel, not Ger, and the Israelite. And so there it is. Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. That's the exclamation point. You get it? There it is, right there. What is he saying? You are a full citizen. You are not even a protected stranger, a Ger. You're a full-on member. You're a full-on Israelite, if you want to look at it that way. So everything that applied to the Israelite now applies to you as a full-on citizen, not a Ger, not a stranger, not a protected stranger. You're part of the nation. You're not a Ger. So you see, whether the rabbis had it right or not, that the law should be carved into these prohibitive civil and religious duties doesn't make a hill of beans difference. I didn't even care to study it if it was to prove it or disprove it. Because either way, it doesn't matter. In Christ, we completely just jump a tier, basically, and go right into citizenship and covenant. So the mainstream argument that the rabbis agree with them, that the law doesn't apply to us completely, is shattered here by Paul, a rabbi that may even agree with the ancients. But carrying out that perspective is inspired to write that we leapfrog over all of that division, that wall of separation, into full citizenship. And you can consider this in light of many other things that Paul wrote. If Paul, for example, was comparing in his mind the Gentiles, to those who were not even not associated with Israel at all, which is quite likely because they weren't in any sense, then why would Paul want them to be? Why would Paul want them to be that? Of what benefit would it be for them to become Ger? And so when you think about that, you think about all the times Paul warned the Gentile converts over and over to go directly to covenant through Yeshua, to trust in him. You're not coming under the protection of Israel. You're not a protected stranger, and therefore needing to show your loyalty to Israel by keeping their laws. We don't practice Judaism. Rather, you leapfrog through all of that and come directly to Yeshua in direct covenant. You become a full citizen, a citizen of the kingdom of God. And as such, then at that point, you say, okay, well, what's the laws of this nation I just became a citizen of? You don't get to be a citizen based on being a Ger and declaring loyalty to the law in order to get there. No, you get there through Yeshua, who makes you part of his nation, and then therefore you keep those laws. This is why Paul would write things like this. Do we then make void the law through this faith in Yeshua? By coming into his kingdom? No! I mean, that's the highest possible no you can get in the Greek. On the contrary, we establish the law. The law is established through citizenship that comes through faith and trust in Yeshua. It does not come, which is what Paul emphasized over and over, it does not come from joining Judaism and becoming a Ger. Obeying the law as a Ger does not make you a citizen. It doesn't make you a citizen, just makes you linked to them. It's not the path to salvation. So while Paul's writings are difficult to understand and his teaching on the law can be convoluted at times, even though his end conclusion is quite clear, but we can understand the teaching that he had and how he wanted to guide these new converts. It's easier to see his perspective on all the law and the rabbi's teachings on it. It's easy to see how it kind of affects his writing. Remember that we read that the Israelites could not own the land permanently? So in that case, the Israelites were Ger to Yehovah. Think about this. It was his land, and they lived as Ger under his protection. The absolute definition of what a Ger is, protected strangers. The Israelites were Ger. Then I read you Ephesians 2, where Paul stated that with Christ you've become fellow citizens and members of the household of God. What's Paul saying? He says they were Ger with Yehovah. Now through Christ, you're not Ger with Yehovah. You're members. You're family. You're part of the tribe. They were Ger. He's saying, you're not. To him, this was a guy. I mean, he probably just said this with such emotion that this is a gigantic thing in Paul's mind. He's like, so why then? Why would one want to become a Ger to Israel or even a pre-Israelite or pre-Yeshua Israelite that is a Ger to Yehovah? Why would you want that if you could be a member? You could be a citizen joined to the family of God. Whether under the provisions of a Ger to Israel or or a ger to Yehovah, neither one of those brings salvation. Only entrance into the tribe membership of God's kingdom brings salvation. And Paul is trying to use all of his perspective to get us to have joy in Yeshua, to understand that we leapfrog over all of this when we put our trust in Him. Just as a stranger would commit their loyalty to the tribe or what have you to become a ger, so are we to give our loyalty to follow Yeshua and all of His ways. But He doesn't respond to us by saying, well, you're a ger. No, He says, you're going to be part of my family, a citizen. And a citizen does what? It obeys the law of the country if you're a good citizen. So there's no difference here. That's why the law is established in Christ. But that law is not the method by which one enters the citizenship. You enter the citizenship through committing loyalty to Yeshua. So what Paul is warning the Gentiles about is not to put themselves under the law as a ger, as a way or a path of trying to enter citizenship. It doesn't work. He says, no, don't do that. Because if you do that, what are you doing? All you're doing is making yourself a ger to Yehovah. You're putting yourself in the same position they did. Paul doesn't want that for them. He wants them to be citizens of the kingdom. So he really sees four tiers. Lowest is no relation to Israel or God at all. Next would be a ger to Israel. Next would be Israel being a ger to Yehovah. And then lastly, a member, a citizen of the kingdom. Why? And if you have that perspective, why would you want to give any inclination to anyone that you're trying to have impact over, to preach to them, to guide them to any of those other tiers? And he didn't. But he has kind of a convoluted way of doing that sometimes. In Paul's writings, the issue for him was never whether the Torah was to be followed. He made those statements over and over again. Look here, Romans 2:12-13. For as many as have sinned without law will also perish without law. Many who have sinned in the law will be judged by the law. What's he saying? In other words, the law isn't going to save you or not save you. I mean, right? What he says is, it's not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. So he's always been staunch on the law, but he's trying to guide them into citizenship. I'm going to read another section of Romans. It's often misunderstood, but I want to read it and put it again in this context of Paul's perspective. He wants people to be doers of the law. The law isn't done away. It's established, as we read. He wants them to be kingdom citizens, right? Not gers of Jerusalem, which, by the way, this term circumcision that we're going to read, it's just another way of referring to Judaism, to being a Jew. Okay, notice this. Romans 2. For circumcision, like Judaism, is indeed profitable if you keep the law. But if you're a breaker of the law, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. It's no good. Therefore, if an uncircumcised man keeps the righteous requirements of the law, will not his uncircumcision be counted as circumcision? And will not the physically uncircumcised, if he fulfills the law, judge you, who even with your written code and circumcision are a transgressor of the law? You see what he's saying? If you become a ger of Israel, a Jew, so to speak, or circumcised, keeping the law as ger just still makes you a ger. If you are circumcised and don't keep the law, then you've even lost your circumcised status, right? Further, he says, the one who's not even a ger, not circumcised at all or even connected, but if he keeps the law, that guy will even judge those that are circumcised. So he's hitting all the tiers here that we talked about, showing that each one relying on the law for membership, for citizenship, doesn't work. Let's continue verse 28. For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men but from God. And so after hitting all those tiers, he can make his point that the relationship has to be a direct one. Not of men, but of God. From the heart. Now he goes on in this next chapter and he explains that basically it's the things that God revealed to the Jews, to Israel, that define righteousness, the law. So he says, they have tremendous advantage. There's tremendous value. But putting yourself under it as a ger without faith in Yeshua does not save you. It can't make you a citizen. And then he concludes the chapter by saying that the law is not void when entering citizenship. It's established. I didn't intend when I sat down to prepare this week's message to give an explanation of Paul's writings. But when I came across what the ancient rabbis taught, and that it was likely what Paul was taught too as a rabbi, I started looking at some of the things he wrote, and I could see this perspective coming through. Paul dearly wanted all that he spoke with, Jew, Gentile, to understand the tremendous work of Yeshua and how he paved the path to real membership in the kingdom of God. Not as some protected stranger, but a member of the family. To the Jew, he could explain it as the next step, the next tier in the plan of God, building on what they had. To the Gentile, it was a real leapfrog type situation, and he needed them to understand that they were not to try to go backwards and try to take the path of a ger, but to accept Yeshua right where they were. Proclaim your faith, proclaim your loyalty to Yeshua, and become citizens. And then, yes, go study the law. Go see us on the Sabbath, in the synagogue. Learn God's ways. You entered that nation as a citizen. Now go be a good citizen. The law is established in the kingdom, but you don't get in the kingdom through the law, not by first being a ger, but through Christ. And that's the end of my rabbi trail from Numbers 15. let's try to finish up the chapter real quick. But I really wanted to bring that to you. The next section after the sacrifice and offerings is laws about unintended sin. And it shows the difference between unintended sin out of ignorance or just a mistake, and doing something knowingly on purpose. That is called a high-handed sin. I'm going to tell you why in a minute. So these unintentional sins and high-handed sins dealt with completely differently. And God also addresses if the sin is done by the whole congregation or by an individual. And by whole congregation, when you read that, you need to remember that generally speaking, it's referring to the leadership and the fact that the people are following the leadership, okay? A big example of that would be like the golden calf, right? The leadership said, hey, let's do this thing. And everybody said, yeah, okay, let's do that, right? And so the whole congregation, right? A modern example in the U.S. would be abortion. It's still today, the many states, it's legal. For decades, it has been a national sin. Even though not everyone agrees with it, not everyone participates in it, but the leadership has made it the law of the land, and so it becomes a national sin. So, anyway, in Numbers 15, we find again certain sacrifices like the olah, the minkah, the atah, are prescribed based on whether or not it's a congregational sin, an individual sin, whether it's done in ignorance, and so on. And he states when those sacrifices are done and you follow, that there is forgiveness. Verse 30, it says, the person who does anything... I've got to go back. Maybe I didn't put it in there. I wanted to read... Yeah, well, take my word for it. Or if you're looking in your Bible, I think it was long about verse 30, somewhere in there or before that. It does say that you do these things and there is forgiveness. Okay, so there was forgiveness in these unintentional sins and stuff as long as they did the prescribed deal. But not so much for the intentional ones. Verse 30, but the person who does anything presumptuously, whether he is native born or a stranger, that one brings reproach on the Lord, and he shall be cut off from among his people, because he has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment. That person shall be completely cut off. His guilt shall be upon him. Now that can be quite disconcerting, for who here has ever committed a sin knowing at the time that it was a sin? Everybody's hand would go up, both of mine. So does that mean that we're all doomed because we have sinned and it wasn't out of ignorance? No. Notice that it says that he despises the word of the Lord, has broken the commandment, right? This word presumptuously comes from the combination of two Hebrew words, and together they paint a picture of being willfully rebelling against God. One of them relates to the hand, and the other relates to raising the hand in power and strength and glory. And so hence, that's why the ancients called this a presumptuous sin. Okay? Because what this means is that this person raises their hand, says, my power, my glory. They're declaring that my strength, my power, and my will, well, it's higher than this, Yehovah, whoever this is, right? You see, it's not a sin of ignorance or even weakness of character to slip and disobey. This is saying, well, I know your law, God, but I know better. My will's better than your will. I therefore reject your law for my own, and I do this thing not in weakness, but in power against you, because I disagree with you wholeheartedly. You're wrong. I'm right. I doubt seriously anybody here has ever risen to that level of sin in their life. And what we find in the very next two verses, that in this context, we get an example of it right after this. Verse 32. Now while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moshe and Aaron and to all the congregation, meaning again, the leaders of the congregation. They put him under guard because it had not been explained to what should be done to him. Understand, again, this is given in context of what we just read. And so I'm convinced the Bible is giving us an example of it, of this high-handed sin. And what you have to ask yourself is, what was this guy doing? Was he out, you know, chopping wood, gathering wood, stockpiling it for the next month because it was going to get cold and he needed to get that work done today? Was he defying the Sabbath in that broad sense? Or was his wife, you know, trying to heat up a Sabbath meal and needed a few more sticks for the fire that she was using? Where is the heart in this? What was the intent? And so they brought him to the leaders to be judged. And Yehovah looked upon the heart, and he said this. He said to Moshe, the man must be surely put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. And so Moshe did what he was said and what God said, and the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him, and he died. So in my view, this is not saying you're getting the death penalty for picking up a stick on a Sabbath. You're not going to get the death penalty for flipping that light switch on and kindling a fire on the Sabbath. Okay? It's not the point. But what it is saying is God is looking on the heart. I'm telling you, this man was in complete defiance. He probably even raised his hand to those around him and said, "This Sabbath thing is stupid. I don't need to rest today. I got too much work to do. God, what are you talking about? I don't even recognize you. If you're that stupid to think that I can't get more work done in 6 days than seven, then what kind of God are you? This is dumb. I got work to do. I'm going to go do my thing." You know, I don't know that that's what he said. I don't know if he said anything. But I can tell you this, that God read his heart. And his heart wasn't to, you know, whatever. He was just willfully rejecting God and his sovereignty to create the Sabbath. This man was saying, "The law be damned. I'm doing what I want." You see, that's a high-handed sin. A high-handed sin. The final section of this chapter concerns the tassels. Read this to you real quick and we'll finish up here. "Speak to the children of Israel, tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and to put a blue thread in the tassels of the corners. And you shall have the tassel, that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them. And that you may not follow the harlotry to which your own heart and your own eyes are inclined. And that you remember and do all my commandments and be holy for your God. Set apart. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God." A few quick things about this, and I've run out of time. But first thing is, how many corners do you have in your garment? Last time I checked, we weren't real square. We were kind of round. Some of us more round than others, but, you know, we're round. Where's the corners? We don't have corners. Actually, this word here means hem, or borders, or edges of the garment. The tassels were to hang in such a way that they could see them, that they could be reminded of Yehovah's commands. They were to be made with a blue thread. Why? Blue is the color of God. And it's to signify, with those tassels and the things, the commandments that they represented were from God. Yehovah wanted them to continue to be reminded of his commandments and walk in them. So he said, make these tassels. But he says, you're not making them to represent me. Remember my command about no graven images? And you can't make anything to remind yourself of me. Don't make yourself something to remind yourself of me. Put that in stone and handed it to Moshe. Don't make things to remind you of me. No, the tassels are to remind you of his commandments. Big difference. Huge difference. Wear them to remember him. to remember those commandments always. That's not a bad idea. Many years ago, I did a message that laid out the very nasty history of the cross and how Satan has inspired that phallic symbol to supposedly represent Christ, even though we're told not to have graven images. I could go on and on about that. I'm not going to. The point is that many people will say, well, I'll wear that cross. It doesn't matter to me. It's history. It just reminds me of Jesus. Well, if you want a reminder of your covenant, of your covenant with Jesus, why don't you do something that reminds you of what that covenant is based on? The commandments. Isn't that better than some phallic symbol? A symbol of method of torture and death? Yeshua didn't stay dead. Okay? That's the good news. So why wave around a symbol of death? By the way, he didn't even hang on a cross. He hung on a stake. So the whole thing's jacked up, you know, thanks to Satan. Why not return to what God designated as a reminder? Something that does not break His commandment of graven images, but something that points us to His wisdom and His ways. Seems a lot better to me. Rather than a symbol of death, have a symbol of life and how to live it. Here's my tassel. Tassels are tied with linen threads. And you can see that blue one that goes all the way through it. Generally, they're tied with 10 knots. There's a double knot in each one of those. One of those knots for each of the 10 commandments. I used to wear this all the time before we moved. I kind of misplaced it and didn't know where it was. I lost track of it. Recently come across it again. I think I'm going to start wearing it again. It was always kind of nice to reach down and feel those knots and just kind of remember how to walk. You know, you get upset and you start to do something stupid, you reach down and you go, okay, yes, God, I'll comply. You know, that kind of thing. I'm going to start wearing it again. Not because it gives me any extra points with God, makes me more righteous, makes me whatever, but it is a constant reminder of what commitments I made in my relationship with God. And it's not a bad thing. Amen? Amen.